Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith.
Currently, we still have more than 13,000 soldiers that are victims of stop loss, and Mark Hall just being one small example.
We're joined by journalist Dar Jamail, author of Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq. He's been on tour with his latest book, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And his February 8th article in Truthout magazine is also about a soldier who has resisted further military service. Iraq War veteran Mark Hall was stop-lost or redeployed after the end of his contract and a 15-month tour. Mark Hall's original protest song about the stop-loss policy landed him in prison in Liberty County, Georgia.
Success got coarse, the army got force, telling me a nigga like me is stop lost. That means I can't get out, my salad got tossed. They fuck me over like a mob boss, high horse.
58,000 soldiers have been stop lost in the past 6 years. Their service involuntarily extended from a few months to more than a year.
At a White House concert February 9th, President Barack Obama praised the singers and songwriters who would risk being sent to jail during the civil rights era as they spoke out for what they believed.
Dr. King himself once acknowledged that he didn't see the real meaning of the movement until he saw young people singing in the face of hostility. But it is hard to sing when times are rough. It's hard to sing in the face of taunts and fear and the constant threat of violence. It's hard to sing when folks are being beaten, when leaders are being jailed.
Senators, congressmen, please heed the call. Don't stand in the doorway, don't block up the hall. For he that...
Among those performing were Bob Dylan and Joan Baez.
Walk hand in hand someday.
Joan Baez reminding her White House audience that Martin Luther King spoke out against the U.S. war in Vietnam. But within hours of the concert, the White House and Pentagon ordered one of the biggest military offensives to date in Afghanistan. As an unembedded journalist in Iraq, Dar Jamail tried to warn Americans that heavy-handed tactics, mass arrests, airstrikes, and torture in U.S.-run prisons in Iraq were causing otherwise peaceful Iraqis to support a growing armed resistance movement against U.S. occupation. Joining us again, Dar Jamail. Dar, welcome.
Thanks, Dory.
Bring us up to speed on this amazing story of Mark Hall and his pending court-martial.
There's an Army specialist. His name is Mark Hall. He did a tour of duty over in Iraq, had a very rough time, saw a lot of horrible things, possibly did some of them himself, came back home. Typical story, Dory. We've talked about examples like this before, I think. He comes back home, traumatized. He's like, well, that was awful, but my contract ends in February. So I've just got to basically hang out for a couple of months, and then I get to go home and be with my child. And instead of that, he's stop lost and told that he's going to be sent back to Iraq. And so in response to this, with great frustration, he, already being a songwriter and singer himself of hip-hop, he decides to write a song called Stop Loss in protest of stop loss. It's a very angry song, but it basically amounts to political hyperbole. And as a result of this, he sent a copy of the song to the Pentagon and played it for his commander, who at first actually liked the song. Then the Army decides to respond by saying, well, actually, we're going to court-martial you. So he's told that he's going to be sent over to Iraq, actually, and be court-martialed in Iraq. He's currently in the United States, although right now, as we speak, he may well be en route over to Kuwait and then to be shipped into Iraq from there. What they're doing is they're stacking the deck. By holding the trial in Iraq, it makes it basically impossible for any of his witnesses and supporters to come be there present for the trial in a war zone, and it even makes it very challenging for his civilian lawyer to get over there. While that may be possible to at least get the civilian lawyer over there, of course, this person will go at great personal danger knowing that, hey, I'm going into the middle of an occupation in a war zone to participate in this trial. So it's a very, very distressing situation because the military filed 5 charges against Mark Hall, and he could end up getting several years in prison possibly over even in Iraq. So it's very, very draconian. And it's really amazing to me because on one hand, we see recent reports of the State Department issuing statements coming down hard on Iran for the measures they've been taking to censor their general population and stifle free speech. And yet here we are, someone in the military exercising their free speech. It is within his right to do so as long as he did so while out of uniform, which he did. And then not only cracking down on him, but basically shipping him halfway across the world to a war zone to have a kangaroo court trial for him and likely imprison him in somewhere in a jail in Iraq.
Yeah, you don't stop. Yo, the Army is the only military branch that still got this stop loss in effect. So only thing I gotta say is prepare for the consequences. When people wanna get out, let them get out.
And that a little bit more of Mark Hall's song. Dart, how did you respond when you first heard this song?
Well, it's an angry song. It's a song where he does make allusions to, you know, in a rage, expressing his rage with a gun. I understood, like, the military's kind of knee-jerk reaction to the song, especially in the wake of the November 5 shooting spree at Fort Hood, Texas, and them being, of course, very sensitive to any kind of threat like this. I can understand that. But on the other end of the perspective, we have to look at the reality of the situation. This is a song, and the military or any institution, government or otherwise, in this country have a right to basically determine what's okay and what's not okay to be art, because this is basically art, and this is the military stepping in and taking it upon themselves to decide what is okay for a soldier to say in a song or paint or write, if it is art or not. And the bottom line is this comes down to a free speech issue. And despite what a lot of people believe, that when people join the military, they give up all their rights, that's simply not the case. Mark Hall and every other person in the U.S. military today does maintain some of their civil liberties, some of their rights. And he does have a right to artistic expression as long as he's doing so. If it is going to be political, he can do that as long as he's not in uniform and doing it not like while in formation or while he's being paid to be in the military. So he followed all the regulations, and he expressed his what is clearly a deep rage and frustration through a very angry hip-hop song. But at the end of the day, it's simply political hyperbole. He then came in response to when the military started to crack down on him and make these accusations that Mark Hall was actually making death threats in his song and threatening his chain of command. He came out and very specifically said, no, these are not threats. This is a hip-hop song. I am in no way a danger to anyone. I don't mean ill towards anybody, my chain of command, or anybody in my unit. This is simply an angry hip-hop song that I use to channel my anger and frustration at this situation because the Army's not keeping up. It's into the deal with my contract after I did. He said, you know, he's saying, I did my tour of duty. I served my country. I did what I'm adhering to the contract that I signed. And the military is breaking their end of the contract. And he's not alone in his rage. I am digressing away from the point. I think I've made the point that this is political hyperbole, and it's not an overt real threat in any way, shape, or form to the military. But Mark Hall, this song and his anger about stop loss is not an isolated case. Despite promises by President Obama to phase out stop loss, of which over 150,000 American soldiers have been subjected to stop loss since September 11, 2001. Currently, we still have more than 13,000 soldiers that are victims of stop loss, Mark Hall just being one small example.
This law that they've used, it's Article 134 of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, but it seems very vague. All disorders and neglects to the prejudice of good order and discipline. Let me just ask you, Dar Jamil, since I know you have covered the story not only of stop loss, but also of suicide in the military and of the devastating consequences of thousands of people who have been stricken with traumatic brain injury, and yet they too can't get out of the military. It's been a nightmare. And so let's just say that the military isn't exactly in good order and discipline today.
No, and again, as we've talked about previously, Dory, the military, from what I see, is really in a state of breakdown where they don't have enough troops to keep both these occupations going, as well as populate the over 800 military bases they have across the planet, you know, not even counting the thousands of bases that they have to populate here in the United States. They're short of troops, and so they are redeploying people 3, 4, 5, 6 times to one or both of these occupations. That means they're dredging up people. They're taking anyone basically with a pulse who applies to the military. You can have a criminal record. You can be a convicted rapist. You can be a gang member. You can be a white supremacist. Come on, join the military. They'll more than happily welcome you in as long as you're willing to go overseas and kill people. That's how desperate they've become. And so as a result, you have them redeploying people who've already served, who have post-traumatic stress disorder, who have traumatic brain injury. We have well over 43,000 troops who've been medically listed as unfit to be deployed, have been deployed anyways to both of these occupations. So again, it's really, really amazing. And I actually was working on another story, actually a book review of a soldier who served as a medic in an operating room in Iraq. And he said after he came back home, he's seen several people firsthand that he knows personally who have told the military, hey, I'm suicidal, and they're sent over to Iraq anyway. Have told people, look, I have severe post-traumatic stress disorder, I can't go, and they're deployed anyway. So this is an ongoing, festering problem that, you know, as this continues forward, is only going to get worse. You know, and then when Obama announces we're going to send 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan, as he did relatively recently, and as he'll do again with probably a different number, probably within another year. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to see this is only going to worsen the problem and deepen the crisis.
Amidst the deafening silence of inaction, the hymns of the civil rights movement helped carry the cause of a people and advance the ideals of a nation. Bernice Johnson Reagan knew this. One day when she was young, she was sitting in a church when a local sheriff and his deputies showed up to intimidate the congregation. They stood at the door, Bernice wrote, making sure everyone knew they were there. And then, she said, a song began. And the song made sure that the sheriff and his deputies knew that we were there.
It seems ironic that the president celebrated the music of the civil rights era and even mentioned the fact, you know, that people went to prison, you know, sang to strengthen themselves and speak out about injustice. But here, a young soldier who feels that the military is in fact not treating him fairly writes a song to express his frustration and winds up in prison.
Right. I wouldn't, at this point, you know, from our Nobel Peace Prize winning and accepting president who is overseeing two massive, brutal, savage occupations and increasing troop deployments to Afghanistan while really not taking anyone out of Iraq as he had promised he would do. With a man who's steeped in this much hypocrisy, I would expect nothing less than him to say these things about people like Joan Baez and Bob Dylan. You know, and again, I'd have to also not save my critique only for President Obama, but to Joan Baez and Bob Dylan for going and singing songs to such a warmongering hypocrite as Barack Obama. I'm not surprised, but I'm still shocked that he can stand up there with a straight face and say these kinds of things while overseeing two massive wars in a country in severe economic crisis and yet continuing on down this road to ruin of the American Empire Project. So, again, shocking, but certainly not surprising at this point.
During the time of the Vietnam War, when the civil rights movement was still on people's minds and many blacks, people of color in general, were being drafted into the military, caught up in a horrific war there, a long, protracted war. And as time went on, we heard many people protest in different ways, some angry, some, you know, wanting to cooperate with even the Nixon administration in finding a way to end this. I mean, there were differences of opinion, but I think people did appreciate the songs in general. Maybe the songs did unify America. I don't know.
At that point, yeah, absolutely, in the 60s, music played a very large role in civil rights movement and anti-war movement, women's movement, all of this coalescing together. I mean, the country was as close as it's been probably since the original revolution against the Brits to really having a real revolution. But today, instead of music being part of a big, powerful, organized movement that really did pose a threat to the government. Instead, music's kind of been relegated to, like Mark Hall's song, of just these kind of isolated instances of rage where people can vent that and vent their dissent and their anger towards the government about what's happening. And so in that way, I think it still plays a really important role, but we have to appreciate the context, you know, and not pretend that it's part of some massive movement that's on the brink of overturning a government for the better. But nevertheless, that doesn't, I think, discount the importance of music and art, writing, all of it together. It's still very, very critical for people to have, including people in the U.S. military, as a way to express their dissent, especially when they're in now, you know, this government military surveillance apparatus that is so overbearing and so oppressive that these are some of the last remaining outlets we have. And now we're seeing Mark Hall being a perfect example of those being shut down.
Let's turn to continuing U.S. war in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iraq. There are, of course, hopes that these wars won't expand into other countries, but we have seen an increase in militarism, both in waters off Iran and in Israel. U.S. military strategy continuing to dominate, even though President Obama had promised more diplomatic solutions.
Well, exactly. If we're going to talk about change with Barack Obama, let's be really clear. He is still operating under the same national security strategy that was updated by the Bush administration back in February 2006. It has not been updated since Barack Obama took the reins of the Office of Presidency in this country. And this national security strategy authored by the Bush administration was basically taken from the neocon blueprint to dominate the world economically and militarily, the project for the new American century. So Barack Obama is doing nothing more than acting as a nice new faceplate, a nice new branding of an American empire project that's the exact same one that we had under Bush. Some of the key changes we can point to for Barack Obama is him, of course, making it much easier for the Wall Street robber barons to loot the country dry. And then another change, of course, we can point to that we've already talked about is him increasing twice now so far massive escalations of troop deployments and private contractor deployments over to Afghanistan. And, of course, him not taking any more troops out of Iraq.
And, Dar, the election coming up in Iraq, what are your thoughts about watching yet another election that has overtones of dangerous futures for Iraq and the people there who have been through so much war already?
Let's talk about Iraq and then let's move out to the broader perspective, as you had mentioned earlier, because they're really more of the same. I mean, Iraq is in an extremely precarious situation right now. Theoretically, we have a national election scheduled for March 7th. That, of course, in the wake of the U.S.-installed Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, and he is installed. Let's remind people yet again, there's no democracy whatsoever in Iraq. These elections are shams. They're elections under military occupation. I mean, can you imagine how legitimate elections would be and how people in this country would consider elections to be if we were militarily occupied by, say, China, for example, and China was running a puppet government here, populated by people who were getting rich off of the Chinese occupation of our country, and then that government was going to hold national elections, how legitimate would we consider those elections? Well, the Iraqi people have the same feelings towards their own. Less than 1% of the people in that country even support their own government. And these elections, up until just a week or so ago, you know, Nouri al-Maliki had banned most of the leading opposition parties, mainly Sunni parties and secular Shia parties, from running against him. So only under severe pressure from the Obama administration, who dispatched Joe Biden to go over there and try to smooth things out, did they change their tune and say, okay, we won't ban these people. Yet still, they're targeting people, they're raiding offices, they're detaining people. So it's all just kind of window washing what we already know and can see to be. It's not going to be a legitimate election. It's extremely corrupt. They're targeting their opponents months before the elections. And, you know, we'll have to see what's going to happen in the aftermath, because when people are denied a political voice and real representation, that sets the stage for much bigger problems in the future. You can only put a lid on this for so long. The violence will probably resume in the aftermath of this if these trends continue. And I see no reason right now for them not to continue. And then we look over at, again, the broader perspective. Afghanistan, Pakistan, U.S. policy regarding Israel. Nora Behrs Friedman released an excellent report on Truth Out detailing how the U.S. is basically stockpiling weapons in Israel, with, of course, Israel having unbridled use of them in case of a quote-unquote emergency situation. Meanwhile, Israel continues its bellicose rhetoric towards both Iran and Lebanon. One of the Israeli ministers saying recently that war with Lebanon was imminent. And then, of course, as a response, we see the Lebanese government led by Saad Hariri, who's now come into a kind of tenuous political coalition with Hezbollah, saying, look, we will stand behind Hezbollah in our own defense if Israel attacks us again, as they did in summer 2006. So a very, very tenuous situation. And again, rather than anything like peace or stability or diplomatic solution starting to come to the surface regarding any of these areas, everything looks like it's headed towards more war.
What's your take on Barack Obama today? I know when he was running, you warned us that his policies were looking a lot like George Bush's policies in terms of foreign policy and military strategy. But does he have the power to even implement change, or is he more or less controlled by other forces? I mean, when he was running, he referred to Jerusalem as the desired capital of Israel, an extremely conservative and controversial statement.
I can see points on each side, where on one hand, Barack Obama has been the most pro-Israeli president, even outstripping Bush. That's saying quite a lot. I mean, this is a guy who literally on the same day he got the Democratic Party nomination to be president, he ran down to AIPAC and gave the most blisteringly pro-Israel, hardcore, pro-Zionist speech a president has ever given there, calling on a unified Jerusalem to be the capital of the state of Israel, to a resounding applause from AIPAC, which is essentially a Zionist lobby group. And I would differentiate, it's really not a lobby group that has Israel's real interests in mind, because Israel's real interests would be peace and security and justice for Israelis and Palestinians, because that would be a real lasting solution that would bring peace to everyone over there. But no, this is a group that wants to basically purge the state of Israel of Palestinians, or at least just relegate them to slaves of Israelis and make a Jewish state of Israel, with Jerusalem, of course, pretending as though there's no Palestinians there as the capital. And Barack Obama supported this and called for this. Of course, then we see a continuance of the building of settlements, a continuance of unbridled military and diplomatic support for Israel by the Obama administration. None of this has changed. It's all continued forward and even escalated in many instances under the Obama administration. And then regarding how much power he really does have over other things, and I think, again, this is still underscores the level of hypocrisy of this man, I think you could also argue that given the fact that we basically have a corporate-driven, militarized government that is hell-bent on global domination, militarily and economically, his hands really are tied, that if he was really going to make radical changes necessary to get us out of this situation that we're in and abandon the American Empire Project, you can rest assured, I don't think this man would be alive for very long if he was going to really make these kinds of changes. You know, we see what happens to people in the past who threatened the American Empire Project. We see what happened to Malcolm X. We see what happened to MLK. And there are other lesser-known examples as well, leaders of the Black Panthers. This is a guy who's basically a faceplate for the American Empire Project, a very good faceplate. And if you were going to really institute some of the radical changes that he alluded to during his campaign for president, again, he would find himself in very, very dire circumstances.
And the neoconservative spokespersons who urged the White House to attack Iran in the past are once again urging the White House and Barack Obama to attack Iran today.
And this is a very interesting situation, because there's heightened bellicose rhetoric, especially just in the last 48 hours, from the White House towards Iran. And, of course, Israel is always frothing at the mouth to attack Iran because they want to remain the only nuclear power in the Middle East. They have more than 200 nuclear weapons. They are the only nuclear armed country in that entire region. Iran is still a long ways off from having enough enriched uranium for even one bomb. Even remember, according to even their own U.S. government's intelligence agencies, that they're at this point a minimum of 3 years away from even obtaining enough for their first small bomb. Meanwhile, we have their neighbor Israel, who proves itself on an hourly basis, their total disregard for international law. Look at how they treat the Palestinians. Look at their unbridled savage attack against Lebanon in 2006 that killed more than 1,300 Lebanese and injured thousands. So they are really the real threat in the region, and yet they continue this rhetoric against Iran. And yet at the same time, the U.S. is in a bind because, as we said earlier, there's not enough troops. So if they open up a whole new front against Iran by greenlighting Israel to go on and attack Iran, what happens when the entire region melts down into regional war? Massive war. I mean, we think things are awful in Iraq and Afghanistan today. Look what happens if someone attacks Iran. This would be very, very different than the U.S. invasion of Iraq, where they went into a country that had already suffered 12 and a half years of the most crippling economic sanctions in modern history against a toothless military of starving poor people with a ruthless, up until recently at that time, U.S.-backed dictator. Well, that is not Iran. Iran is three times the size of Iraq. It does have a military, three times the population, a mountainous region. And if the U.S. or Israel thinks they're going to just launch a war against it and not have severe repercussions, they know better. And I think that is really the main reason to date that we haven't already seen a war against Iran. It's because in military terms, the U.S. simply can't afford it.
Dar, you've been on a book tour, touring the U.S. to talk to people about your story of the will to resist within the U.S. military. What about that will to resist in general as it applies to both the military and civilians in the United States and other countries? Can we stop a war?
There are isolated pockets of resistance within the military. It's not just both of these occupations, but other horrible repressive elements in the institution that is the U.S. military today. So against racism, against homophobia, against military sexual trauma when soldiers sexually assault other soldiers, which is rampant in the military. One out of three women and as many as one out of 10 men in the military will be sexually assaulted at some point during their contract while they're serving in the U.S. military. So all these different types of resistance are happening within the military. And again, I think we look back, history shows us that a powerful, organized GI resistance movement like what we had during Vietnam could play a very pivotal role in forcing the government to end their wars of aggression. It worked during Vietnam, but the thing is, today we do not have anything like an organized, widespread GI resistance movement. But there is a lot of problems in the military. There is a lot of dissent. Morale is very, very low. Everyone I talk with say, look, I'm just the tip of the iceberg here talking about low morale. It's everywhere. It's just most people are too afraid to take a stand because they don't want to go to jail. They don't want to lose their benefits. And mostly they see the economy. And the economy is why they joined the military to begin with. And now it's what's keeping them in. So these are some of the factors working against the formation of a broader movement. But again, I think the message that people in the civilian population can take from the Mark Halls, the Victor Augustos, the Sergeant Travis Bishops, all these people that we talked about on the show before, Dory, these people in the military with very high levels of integrity that decide to put it all on the line and say, look, I'm willing to go to jail. I'm willing to lose my benefits. I'm willing to have a criminal record according to the military by not following these orders because it's simply the right thing to do. And the example that these people set for us in the civilian population is this question. If these people are willing, with all that at stake and the hammer that's surely going to come down on them for taking a stand, if they're willing to do that simply because it's the right thing to do, what are we willing to do to try to stop these wars?
Dar Jamail, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Dory.
Award-winning journalist Dar Jamail. He'll be speaking at the University of Arizona in Tucson, March 8th. You can read his articles in Truth Out, The Nation, The Sunday Herald, Interpress Service, Le Monde Diplomatique, and many other outlets on his website, dahr.org. That's dahr.org. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program produced in Storrs, Connecticut. TalkNationRadio.org for transcripts, audio, and discussions.